Welcome to the podcast Benzo Tired. I'm your host, Neftel Benesty, and I'm Dutch. Join me on my journey into the world of benzodiazepines, withdrawal, bind, and more. Disclaimer, always consult your physician for medical advice. This is episode 29, Nicole Lamberson, and today it's October 17th, 2023. In this episode, Nicole Lamberson, physician assistant. She has lived experience in that she is enduring protracted injury from prescribed psychiatric drug, polypharmacy, and an over-rapid withdrawal that occurred in a detox center back in 2010. Nicole is involved in various withdrawal-related initiatives, including she serves on the Medical Advisory Board of Benzodiazepine Information Coalition, is an associate at the International Institute for Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, is a founding member of the Benzo Action Work Group of the Colorado Consortium, is a co-founder of the Withdrawal Project and a team member at Inner Compass Initiative. She also does outreach, marketing, and distribution for the documentary film Medicating Normal. Currently, she is a member of the patient panel tasked with assisting the American Society of Addiction Medicine on the development of benzodiazepine deprescribing guidelines for the FDA. Be advised, this episode may be perceived triggering for some people. Hi, Nicole. Welcome to Benzo Tired.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for being on. Can you share with the audience where your benzodiazepine story begins?
Sure. So long, long ago in the early 2000s, I had just graduated from PA school, which I don't know if in your country you have PAs, but in the US we have, they're called physician assistants.
We do. We have them.
Okay. Yeah. So I was young, you know, about 25 years old at that time, and just graduated from school. And I was working my first job. In hindsight, because, you know, that's always 2020 in our situations, I think it was a bit of, you know, the feeling you get when you're starting a new job, that most people are like nervous, like, am I going to screw this up? Compounded with the fact that, like, I had people's lives in my hands and I was like fresh out of PA school. And I also had kind of like a creep for a boss, but I felt the pressure of, well, this is my first job. I kind of have to stay here at least for a year or two to have something on your resume, because it's really hard, you know, to get hired with no experience. So I think it was a combination of all of that, plus general, you know, like life things of just being a human, relationships and stuff. And so actually one of the physicians at the practice where I worked at, I told him one day, like, I just don't feel right. Like, I need to go home for the day. And also at the time I was eating, like, way back then was when, oh, what is that diet that was like loaded with aspartame? Oh gosh, I'll remember it. This is like how my benzo brain does. I'll think
That's okay. We all have it. But, you know, so basically no sugars then?
No sugars, but like aspartame is not like the greatest replacement that we know now. It can have, you know, all kinds of adverse effects in people and stuff like that. Yes. So, and I didn't really need to be on a diet, but I was doing it because my roommate was, and, you know, so maybe that played a part too. I don't know. But so, you know, I asked to go home from work, and the doctor was like, oh, that's stress. You know, that's anxiety. So he wrote me a prescription for Xanax at the time.
To now, take it every day or incidentally?
It was like a PRN, I think. I can't really remember, but I think it was kind of presented to me in that way, like half milligram PRN, whenever you need it type of thing.
Okay.
And prior to that, I had been on, Wellbutrin, which wasn't called Wellbutrin, it was called Zyban, even though it's the same drug, but I was using it to quit smoking before I went to PA school. So if you believe in the whole kindling phenomenon that, you know, prior drug withdrawals can kind of set the stage, you know.
Right.
Yeah, I had come off and on that and stayed on it for I don't know how long trying to quit smoking with it, so.
Right, right. Okay, so you get the Xanax prescription, and how do you start using it?
It really was like PRN. I think I was just taking it every few days or like once a week or, you know, something like that. And it was sort of like in my mind, it's like, all right, this is for work stress, you know, so I definitely wouldn't take it on the weekends. But yeah, not much longer after I started taking it, like a couple months, I started getting new psychiatric symptoms. So I think, again, in hindsight, I didn't know at the time anything about this. I had no medical training. You know, I had just gotten out of PA school, is the irony, and we hadn't learned about this or this class of drugs at all, other than the basics, you know, like they can cause seizures and they can be addictive, which we can get into that later about like my hangups with the language and how harmful I think it is the way that we talk about these drugs. But so in hindsight, I think I was already having like some inner dose withdrawal type problems that I didn't recognize as from the drug. And I just sort of attributed them to myself, like, what the hell's wrong with me? Like, am I really losing it? Am I developing some weird anxiety disorder? I was also starting to get like depressed and even suicidal at times.
Wow.
So that freaked me out. That scared me. And I started seeing a psychiatrist. And that's like my entry into the mental health system, really.
And what does the psychiatrist tell you to do?
I think that's when I was put on benzos daily. So it became a, you know, this is how short-term intermittent use kind of opens the door for long-term use in people. And I also got, you know, the revolving door of polypharmacy is when it started. So it was like antidepressants, and there was no mention like, hey, maybe you just started this med, you know, a handful of months ago.
Right.
It's very possible this is the culprit. There was never any discussion of that at all.
Did you get switched to Xanax or another, like daily Xanax, or did you get another benzo, or how did that go?
It's all kind of like a mess in my mind because I don't remember a lot of that time, to be honest. I saw, like, I moved finally from that first job, and it was like a 30-minute move. So I got a new psychiatrist that was in like closer to my new job and my new home. And that's who I stayed with for the duration. Like the most of the drugging that was happening was not the original psychiatrist. Over that 5-year period that I was with her, she put me on Klonopin. So that was the longer acting benzo, 1 milligram 3 times a day.
Whoa, oh my God.
The listeners can't see your face, but I can, right?
That's insane. I mean, yeah. I've heard crazier stories about 6 milligrams of Klonopin, but still, it's such a solid dose.
Yeah. But it sounds so small, just tiny little 3 little milligrams, you know.
Right.
People don't know it's 60 milligrams of Valium equivalent.
Right.
When that, you know, stopped working because tolerance happens, we know, I got the Xanax back and she placed it in between the 2 doses of Klonopin.
So there's Klonopin and then Xanax gets added in between. So you are on the 2 most potent benzodiazepines known to men right now.
Yeah, together at the same
time. Oh my gosh.
So that was 0.5 milligram twice a day in between the 3 Klonopins.
How are you at this stage? How are you doing? How are you physically, mentally, and all these drugs?
Well, I mean, I wasn't doing well. I was deteriorating slowly over time. But I think with benzos, not everybody. I mean, some people are so lucky, right, that they can kind of figure it out and make the connection early. Like, okay, this doesn't make sense. I just added this drug and look at how weird I'm acting, or like something is wrong, you know. But I didn't figure it out. I mean, I think in hindsight, I was more likely, which is odd because I was trained medically, right? You would think that somebody medically trained would recognize it more. But I think I was more sort of brainwashed in the system to think like doctors know everything. You know, I had just been trained by a whole bunch of them. I worked for them. I respected them a lot. I was proud of my new profession and thought like, oh, you know, this is a helping profession. We help, we don't harm, you know? And so the whole concept of drug harm was like not even on my radar at all. And, you know, some of the board questions even that you have to answer is like, you know, Johnny's feeling depressed and he this and that. And which of the following drugs do you give him? So it's, there's not even an answer for like, you don't give him drugs, like you get him psychotherapy or you,
right.
you know. So it's like, it's just the way that I was thinking at the time, I think.
Right.
And my dad's a physician. My sister's a nurse. Like I just grew up in medicine, you know? And so I think I just had this false sense of security. And I really believed like, if you go to the doctor and you follow their directions, you're helping yourself. You're getting, I mean, we call it mental health, right? I thought I was being healthy by doing this. But yeah, I was deteriorating over time, but it was so insidious that it wasn't like a major thing where I could be like, holy crap, it's the drug. You know, I didn't have a moment like that until much later.
Yeah, I had the same for me. It was a very gradual process and I didn't even know it was the benzos until I just decided to want to come off of them.
Yeah.
So what happens after a few years and you get tolerance? When does your aha moment kind of happen in terms of the benzos?
Well, I actually got more polypharmacy over time because, you know, I was getting more adverse effects. The tolerance was getting worse. I was having interdose withdrawal. It was to the point where I was like crawling out of my skin at work, like trying to do my job, like so agitated and all these like muscle cramps in my neck, which I know now were benzos, you know, like where I would be like licking a pill at work just to, you know, like finish my shift.
Wow.
And so I also got, because this psychiatrist didn't recognize what was happening, she diagnosed me with like worsening mental illness, air quotes, because we know that's not what it was.
Right.
And I was seeing a therapist in her practice. They kind of came as a package deal and the therapist was, you know, driving that message home for me as well. Like, we really have to manage your mental illness. You know, it's getting worse. You know, this is serious and all of this. So I got Ambien on top of it at bedtime because I was having insomnia from some of the tolerance and interdose. And I was having insomnia because she had added Adderall at one point because I was so sedated, you know. It was like I would sleep a lot during the day, but it was like I was like riddled with fatigue because I'm on a huge dose of tranquilizers and I was like 110 pounds or something, you know. And I think the Adderall too was because she had tried SSRIs or SNRIs and I had bad reactions to them. Like I have a vivid memory of calling the office on a Saturday, like using the emergency line, like something is horribly wrong. Like I'm crawling out of my skin after one dose of Lexapro or something. I don't remember which one it was. It was like, oh, well, Adderall could, you know, boost your mood. So I was on Adderall as well. 10 milligrams twice a day. At some point I got Remeron because the Adderall made me stop, like have no appetite. And Remeron's supposed to enhance your appetite.
Yeah. The generic is mirtazapine. And I got that prescribed for a little bit, but I didn't respond well to it. But a lot of people in benzo withdrawal get prescribed the Remeron as well. So this whole cocktail of yours is Xanax, Klonopin, Ambien, Adderall.
And Seroquel.
Seroquel.
Bedtime for sleep as well.
Oh my
25
goodness.
Milligrams. Yeah. So I'm on 6 drugs by the end of 5 years of seeing this.
How are you living? How are you living in with all of these drugs? How are you functioning?
Well, it was becoming where I wasn't anymore. I, you know, was calling out of work constantly because I couldn't get myself out of bed. I couldn't figure out what the hell was wrong with me. Like I'd make a dentist appointment and I just could not make myself get in the car to go. I was having weird psychiatric symptoms in hindsight, which are very classic benzo, I think. Like if a neighbor rang the door, I would freak out and like run and hide in my house. Like, what the hell is this? You know, why am I scared of the doorbell? I started having like weird kind of OCD type thinking. Like there was all these flowers and plants and stuff out in the flower beds of the home that I had bought. And I remember, like, they bothered me so much. I don't know what it was, like, the chaos of them or whatever, that I went out there and, like, ripped every plant out of the ground until my flower beds were barren. I was like painting spots on the front of my house with a hand paintbrush because I was like so obsessed with the fact that there were like these imperfections, really manic, weird, crazy stuff, you know, was happening. Yeah.
I've never come across someone so polydrugged as yourself. So I'm like in utter shock. So when does this change? When's your aha moment?
Okay. So my dad, who's an anesthesiologist, had kind of noticed like something is not right. I mean, he's known me my whole life, you know, and I was having all these meltdowns, like mood instability, crying all the time. Well, I had come up with this grand idea that all of everything that was wrong with me was just I was under too much stress. Like, that's what it felt like. Like, I couldn't handle my life. Like, anything was too much. I mean, I have a vivid memory of just having to get myself together to go to a Christmas potluck. And I had like a complete meltdown because I couldn't do everything it required, like get myself dressed, pack up the mashed potatoes or whatever the hell I had made. And so I had to enlist my roommate at the time to like help me just get out the door, you know, to go. So my dad had noticed like something is not right, you know. I was barely hanging on at my job. I think I was on FMLA, which is family medical leave at the time. Like I had taken a break, which was in the States. I don't remember the rules, but like you're allowed a certain amount of time where they can't fire you or something if you have medical release. And of course, my psychiatrist was like, oh, yeah, you're mentally ill. I'll write the note, you know.
Okay.
So I'm just struggling all around to function. So I'm like, it's my job. It's my life. Like I'm owning this big house by myself. I have a roommate, but you know, the responsibility of the home is mine. And so I was like, I know what I'll do. I'll sell my house. I'll get a job that has less hours, like a normal, you know, 8 to 3 or something like that. And I'll move. And I'll just start over. I'll rent a place instead of owning. So I actually did it. In hindsight, it was a good move because as sick as I got, if I still would have had that mortgage or anything, I would have been totally screwed, you know, because I couldn't work after my withdrawal. So I moved to this place where I literally know nobody. I don't even know why in my like deranged mind that I picked this town. It was like a beach place. I don't know. Right. I was like trying to set myself up for this, you know, relaxing, I don't know what, like I really thought this was going to solve everything. Mm-hmm. Well, I got there and I started the new job. I was so cognitively impaired. I couldn't learn like the new computer system to start the new job. I also had certifications that had to be up to date in order to work there. They were expiring. And no matter how hard I tried to sit with the books to read and like update myself for the tests, I couldn't study, I couldn't read, nothing. So the certifications lapsed, which meant I couldn't have the job anymore. I was functioning zero in this new place. Like I just spent I was only there for 30 days before it all fell apart, but I just laid in bed constantly, just, you know, sick. And I went like tried finding new therapists there and would just sit in the office and cry hysterically. I mean, they were like so worried about me. They were calling my dad back at home, the therapists and stuff that I was seeing, like she needs to go inpatient or like something is horribly not right, you know?
Right.
I finally told my dad, like, something is wrong. I need help. I don't know. And by this time, he had found an article in Outside Magazine, which is a sports magazine here in the United States that he happened to subscribe to. And Matt Samet, if you're familiar with him.
He wrote Death Grip, right?
Yeah, he wrote Death Grip. But he had written, the first thing he ever wrote about his story was in Outside Magazine, and it was called Beauty and the Breakdown. And my dad read it and gave it to me. And I was like, holy, can we curse?
Yeah, you can. Holy shit. Yeah. Holy shit. This is me.
Yeah. It was like he finished my sentences. Like he described how I felt. Like it made everything suddenly made sense. Like I was being poisoned by this cocktail of stuff. It, you know, it's funny to me though that it's like all it took was somebody telling me like, hey, the drugs could actually cause this for me to connect the dots.
Right.
Which like if people got informed consent in the beginning, they could be looking for this stuff, you know, like, yeah. But I just for 5 years, I didn't even suspect once until I read Matt's story, like that the drugs could be causing any of it.
And what do you think about then? Like, should do you like go online to find information on how to taper? What happens?
I was just desperate at that point. Like, I want this shit out of my body. You know, like now that I have an answer for why I've been like this, like I just want it gone. Reading back Matt's article, he did mention Heather Ashton in the writing, and I don't know if I was like savvy enough at the time, like, oh, I should go look for this woman. You know, keep in mind I was having trouble reading, processing.
You were cognitively impaired. Yeah.
Yeah, totally. So I did sort of search around on the internet, but I found more of the medical sources that were like, yeah, this person can, you know, this case study, we took this benzo person and put them on phenobarbital for 5 days and detoxed them and they were fine. So I remember having this argument, and my dad and I even talked about it, like, why would I taper? Here's this paper, this medical journal that says you can just go get off of it, you know. And I also was aware of the seizure risk, so I was like, oh, maybe it makes more sense to like be in a like a monitored environment, you know, with somebody watching me in case I have a seizure. Like, I knew nothing,
right?
Obviously,
right
yeah. So, but I did have a sense that like something about the whole thing was weird, because when I came home almost immediately after reading the article and like having the conversation with my dad, he's like, come home, we'll find you a place. Like, we'll figure this out, you know?
So you moved back in with your parents or your dad?
I didn't move back in. That's the funny part. Like in my mind, this was going to last a short period of time and I was going to like go back to my job. So I took a 30-day leave. I kept all my stuff at the new place that I had rented. It was still in boxes. That's how sick I was. The 30 days I had managed to like not unpack a single thing. Like I was struggling to go to the mailbox at that place. Like the landlord, I think even at one point called my dad and asked like, is she okay? Like the mail is coming, like spewing out of the mailbox, because I literally just was totally non-functional at that point.
Yeah. Right. Okay, so you go back to your dad's thinking that this journey would be like 30 days or whatnot, or
yeah, I'll be back in 30 days, better than ever.
You know? Right, and you find this facility or whatnot, or
yeah, just in town, like around where my parents lived, you know, a local place, and that was because, you know, my dad is an anesthesiologist. He doesn't write prescriptions for people long term. He sees you once, puts you to sleep, and like you're on your way, you know.
Right,
so he uses benzos, but appropriately in his practice to put people to sleep once. So he knows of them, what he knew of them, but he's not a psychiatrist, you know. So he asked around like friends in the medical field, acquaintances, etc. And so you know what answer he got back, right? Like, oh, well, if your daughter's having a benzo problem, she needs to go to a detox center. So that was the advice that we had gotten from like some colleague psychologist.
And you're still on this cocktail. It's not just the benzos, right?
Yeah, it's everything.
Right. Okay.
Yep. So we went and checked the place out, and I realized like it's a 12-step like addiction facility. And I remember having this conversation with my dad, like, this doesn't make any sense though. Like, every single person who goes to a psychiatrist then has to go to like a detox, like a 12-step rehab. Like, how does that make any sense? Like,
it's just the weirdest thing. Yeah.
Yeah. But I still was just like, whatever. Like, I want this crap out of my body. And my dad was like, that's just how all the facilities are. You know, they're all like that. You're not going to find one that's not like that. So I was just like, all right, you know, I'm signing up. Let's just get this over with, you know.
Okay.
So.
And you go in. I'm kind of like, oh, scared already. But okay, you go in. What happens?
I go in, and so I've described you my level of function, you know, non-functional, but I was still like, I drove my car home from my rental place to my parents' house, which was like 7 hours, you know. The night before I went to the detox place, I still went and like hung out with a girlfriend who was like local to my parents' town. You know, I was still like able to be a human being. I was just struggling, you know, really, really badly. So I get there, I'm there for the 30 days or whatever. They essentially rip me off of all the drugs they deem quote unquote addictive, you know. So only the bad ones in the mind of these rehab centers.
The bad ones. Okay, so it wasn't the plan to get you off of all of the drugs.
That is what I asked for when I went in there. I was like, all of it. I want all of it, you know, get it out of like I'm done with this stuff. I just want to see what I am without these drugs. But they were like, no, you know, those places operate from they put drugs in a category of bad. And those are the ones that are sometimes, you know, misused or abused. And then good. So they're very much in the medical model of, you know, so-called mental illness, where the Seroquel I was on was perfectly fine in their eyes. The Remeron was okay, but not the Ambien, not the Xanax, not the Klonopin, and not the Adderall. So all that had to go.
Okay.
So, yeah. So they stop all of it. There was no taper, even though it wouldn't have mattered. I mean, the tapers, if you can even call it that, in the places like that, or, you know, sometimes they just slowly, like over 2 weeks or something, bring you down. But they didn't do that in my case. They gave me phenobarbital instead, which is a, you know, barbiturate that they use to keep you from having seizures. And that was like a 6-day like decreasing dose of phenobarbital. And then they gave me a huge dose, like 9 to 1200 milligrams of gabapentin, I guess is how they keep you from seizing. Okay. I think along the way, more things, like they tried to give me trazodone. And they tried doubling my Seroquel as well, because I think my sleep like totally, you know, went to hell as soon as they did what they did. When they doubled my Seroquel, I actually lost consciousness and like busted my head open on the concrete floor at the place and wound up in the emergency room having a CT scan of my head. The whole thing was just, you know, a complete and total nightmare.
I know it's super, super dark, but can you remember how you felt in this period of time?
Yeah, I mean, I remember thinking like, how are all these people who were taking like massive doses of fentanyl or heroin or street drugs or whatever, like outside playing soccer now? And I can't like even barely leave my room. You know, I'm like in my bed rocking. I'm so agitated. I would cry constantly. I remember like waiting in line at the window for your meds in the morning, like they'd give them to you in a little Dixie cup thing. And one of the other people at the detox place put like a cold drink on the back of my neck. I think he was just being playful, you know, like saying good morning, but I jumped so much and like screamed at him like a rage episode or something. Like I was like not, you know, I was starting to be in active acute withdrawal. I was like sit outside and I remember just like shaking violently. I was afraid to go on the bus that they tried to force people on to go to these 12-step meetings. Like I was having agoraphobia. Like how am I going to get on this freaking bus, you know? And all these other people were like having a good time, like making friends with the other people there, you know?
Right.
And I just never like advanced to, I guess like the next phase is you could move out. It was still on the same property, but they had apartments where you weren't like living in a room next to the nurse's station. But I like never really was able to do that because I was just so messed up, you know?
And I do wonder though, did this facility never once think like, hey, she cracked her head and obviously she is very sick and dysfunctional. Maybe we have to change something about our, you know, therapy, no. something.
No. Yeah, I mean, there weren't even really, like, the doctors didn't meet with you on a regular basis. They would just show up, like, on, you know, Tuesdays or something in a group setting for a meeting. It was, like, really not hands-on. And so most of it was just, like, therapy all day with the whole 12-step model, which I felt, I don't even understand why I'm doing this, because it doesn't make, like, I don't want to take this stuff, right. you know. All of the 12-step messaging was about, like, your cravings and your desire to use and wanting to get high. And I'm like, I don't, like, this doesn't make any sense for my situation. And when I talked to my dad about it, he's like, just stay, like, get it over with, you know, and you'll be out of there. That was kind of like what I was trying to do, just like hunker down and get through it and get home and just be done, you know.
And were you done after these 30 days?
It hadn't even begun.
No. Okay. So tell the audience what happens after this treatment.
Yeah. So I come home, and honestly, there were times actually where I kind of felt better, like, oh, maybe, you know, I'm improving. And that could have just been because I was on such a big cocktail of polypharmacy that alone will make you feel like crap. You know, I had all these drugs in my system. And so maybe the adverse effects kind of fell off and I felt some relief from some of that. But of course, I mean, I was still struggling really bad. Like, I didn't want to come out of my room once I got home. I kind of just laid around still. Like, I didn't function that well other than, like, you know, forcing myself to meet up with some old friends or things like that. But it wasn't what happened 4 months later, which was the delayed withdrawal kicked in. I don't know if you've met anybody who had that happen, but.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Well, I've had people that tapered and then, like, maybe a month later it hit, but it's not uncommon, but 4 months is just kind of a very much delayed reaction, but it does happen. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Luckily there were other people. I didn't join the groups until the 4 month period when, you know, shit hit the fan. I was like, holy, like, what is this fresh hell? You know,
so what happened after these 4 months? And you're not off all the drugs yet, but this is just the benzos.
Yeah.
Right?
I think I was still, like, taking the gabapentin still and the Remeron and Seroquel and maybe even trazodone if they had added that, like, the, you know, the cocktail from the.
Right. Right. But this is like the benzos are now 4 months.
Everything. Yeah. Is okay. gone. The Adderall's gone. All the benzos, the sleeping pills, totally gone. Yeah. I mean,
okay. So what happens after the 4 months?
I got akathisia. So I started pacing incessantly. I mean, I was hysterical, completely inconsolable, you know, crawling out of my skin. I started having, like, the racing, terrible thoughts, intrusive thoughts, like intense suicide ideation, burning skin, you know, perceptual distortions. The room is spinning. I remember one time I had vertigo so bad that I felt like I had to, like, put my foot outside of the bed to put it on the ground to, like, stop the bed spinning. It felt like somebody, like, put the bed up on a stilt and, like, spun it, like one of those wow. childhood things at the, yeah. you know, playground when you were younger. That's how it felt like my bed was doing that. And I'm on it, you know.
Oh, my, like, God.
Yeah. Completely, completely devastated with symptoms from just head to toe.
And did you link that to the benzo withdrawal that happened, like, 4 months before? Or were you like, what the hell is this? Or
yeah, at this point, I'm like, okay, you know, and my dad is seeing me get worse. Although, you know, in medicine, most things are linear. So you cut yourself, the cut heals slowly over time in, like, a pretty linear fashion. So when I'm screaming at him, like, it's getting worse. And he's like, that doesn't make any rational sense. Like, how is it you're 4 months off and you're actually getting worse? You know, it wasn't until I found the groups later that I met other people who had similar delayed withdrawal syndromes. So then it made sense why it was getting worse. But at this point, I'm like, okay, I have to figure something out. I think my dad had ordered Baylissa's book from Amazon. I can't remember the name of it. Oh my God, she's gonna kill me. I love Baylissa.
Yeah.
Sorry, Bay. It's my Amanda brain. Oh my
It's
God.
Okay. It's okay. But we, yeah, I know her from, you know, the books and everything. So, okay. So you get the book.
Get the book. And in the back is hyperlinks to like Benzo Buddies and like groups and stuff. This was back in 2010, so a lot of the stuff we have now did not exist. It was kind of like a barren wasteland with like one tumbleweed out there in the internet at the
right,
time.
Right,
there
right.
was like one YouTube video of a guy named Brian Baxter called Welcome to Hell was the name of it. It wasn't like today where we have all these Facebook groups and like thousands of videos and organizations. None of that existed. There was Benzo Buddies. BenzoWithdrawal.com, which is now defunct, gone, and something called Benzo Island, which is also closed. But it was enough where I could read and be like, oh my God. Yeah. But I still was having some level of denial. Like, I'm ashamed to admit that I read, you know, some of the forums and I saw people saying they were still sick at like 7 years off. And I thought to myself, something has to be wrong with these, like, there's no freaking way, you know?
You just can't imagine that a journey for with benzodiazepines can take years, if not indefinitely.
Yeah.
It's just, I'm unfathomable. You just can't.
Yeah. And I'm guilty of the same medical thinking of some of the doctors who it's like, well, these are psychiatric meds, you know, so how do we know that this isn't some people's like underlying disorder stuff coming back, you know?
Right.
So I am so sorry for thinking that way. But, you know, that's kind of the stuff that I, in my own denial, I think to save myself the reality that this could go on for that long, I think I had to find an excuse for, you know.
Right. So how long does your protracted withdrawal, at least from the benzos, how long does your suffering kind of last?
I still am not symptom free today. It's 2023 and I detoxed in 2010.
Okay. When did you notice some slight improvement in your condition?
Well, okay. So at the 4 month period, like I said, it became severe. I got to the point where I just couldn't tolerate it. I had a suicide attempt where I overdosed on Seroquel and wound up in the ICU. At that point, I realized I can't keep doing this. Like, I'm not going to survive this. It's too bad. Even in the emergency room, the ICU, I was like desperately trying to explain to these doctors that I'm in severe benzo withdrawal. And they just didn't, you know, they would be like, oh, she's just, you know, drug seeking or, you know, whatever. In that time, my dad was digging around a little bit more with his connections. And one of the surgeons that he operated with was married to a psychiatrist. We got in touch with her and made an appointment. In that time, too, I had gone back to the psychiatrist who got me into this mess, you know, the 5-year lady. Well, she didn't get me into it, but she extended, you know,
right,
she wasn't
right.
the first doctor, but she's the one I saw for the longest. She denied, you know, she said, oh, having problems with benzos is rare, you know, and she gave me some book to read about anxiety. I think it was like Claire Weeks' anxiety book or something. So I quickly was realizing there is like zero help to be had for this problem.
Yeah.
I think I'd seen an addiction medicine specialist too, and who like tried to give me Lexapro, and I was like, okay, like I'm screwed. But the wife of this surgeon was not knowledgeable on the topic, but she was willing to learn. So she read Ashton, she listened to my dad explaining, like she was the first doctor that I met that wasn't totally skeptical and who was like, all right, I'm gonna read this stuff. And it was probably because I was lucky enough to have, you know, this association with,
right,
you know, my dad knowing her husband. And I think most people, like lay people who aren't in the medical field, even though I being in the medical field and bringing my dad to all these appointments with me before didn't get me very far.
Mm-hmm.
I think probably regular people have an even harder time like finding medical care and being believed, you know?
True.
So luckily I got this woman and she's been on my team now since, you know, early 2011 after I had the suicide attempt and I got out of the hospital and was able to link up with her.
So how could your treatment look like? Because I mean, I'm presuming here that you didn't instate a benzo again, or did you?
I did.
Oh, yeah. You did. Okay.
Yeah.
It's so always tricky, back, you know? Yeah.
I went back on Valium, or I went on Valium, not back on, because I'd never taken it before.
Right.
Because the only thing she knew is Ashton. That's, I had given it to her. So we were kind of like figuring this out together. I threw all the other drugs in the trash, the, you know, non-benzos, and was just like, I'm not doing this.
Wait, the Seroquel, the Remeron, you just tossed it?
Totally threw it away. Okay. Yeah, I figured, I was like, I'm already screwed. Like, I'm already suffering. You know, I'm not, I don't want to be on any of this stuff anymore. And the Valium took the edge off enough where it was like, I could sustain in that. Like, I didn't have to kill myself. I could, I mean, I was still really, really sick. It did not, you know, work miracles. I didn't take it. And I was like, oh, I'm suddenly back to myself and stabilized and can function. And part of the reason is probably because I did what some, you know, a lot of people do. I was scared of the drug. I was terrified of it. I remember thinking before I went back on Valium with this doctor, like maybe I'll just reinstate myself. And I held Klonopin in my hand for days until it melted. Like it was like a wet pile of cornstarch because I was so afraid of it. Like, but I had a sense like, well, I was all right, like better on it before. So maybe I should go back, but I just couldn't make myself take it. I was too scared of the drug, you know?
So how many milligrams of Valium do you instate at this point?
I think I went on 20 was the reinstatement, which is way less in equivalence than what I had come of. And I think that was a mistake, honestly. If I had it to do over, I would have gone back on Klonopin probably, and I would have gone back on the equivalence of what I had come off of at least to try to get stable. Yeah.
And did you suffer any withdrawal experiences from the Seroquel that you tossed and the Remeron, or not like
it's
noticeably?
So hard.
It's hard because you're already in torture and in hell and like what I was like, causing what? Yeah.
Yeah. Riddled with
symptoms. So you're on 20 milligrams of Valium, and then what happens? Do you stabilize at some point, or?
No.
You never did?
Okay. No. I mean, my goal, again, this was probably, you know, my lack of education at the time and poor guidance. I mean, Benzo Buddies and those groups had scared the crap out of me because they put that messaging out there, like, if you ever reinstate, you're going to be trapped in hell forever. It's never going to work. It's the worst idea. You have to stick this out. And I think that's why I stuck it out for as long as I did and then wound up having a suicide attempt, you know, because it was unsustainable. It was that bad. I couldn't do it anymore.
Right.
So I would have reinstated way sooner if I would have known better. But no, I didn't. I think so much damage had been done in the months that I was just off and, you know, in florid benzo withdrawal that I didn't stabilize. And I don't think I was on near enough, you know, drug. I was on what? I mean, if you do the math, maybe like a quarter of less than a quarter of my original dose. I've met people who stabilized 18 months or so after cutting their dose in half, but it took that long, you know, like waiting for a year and a half before they stabilized. So I probably should have sat on Valium a lot longer than I did if I was only going to stay at 20 milligrams, but you know,
but you started tapering.
I did, but I did that is one thing that I learned quickly at the time was the microtaper method using milk. So that's one thing to get off of the last 20 milligrams that I had reinstated. I microtapered using milk titration to get off of it.
How did that go?
I think I mean, the akathisia didn't come back, which was huge. When I reinstated the 20 milligrams, that stopped the akathisia. And I think that's what allowed me to survive this thing. I was still like desperately ill though. I mean, I had bed sores from laying in bed for so long. My hair was like matted into dreadlocks from rubbing on the pillow. I didn't leave my house barely at all. I remember I had a laundry facility where I was staying, because by this time, my parents had moved me into my own apartment, like down the street. So I had my own space, and they could check on me because they were right around the corner. But the laundry facility was not in my apartment, and I had agoraphobia and stuff so bad that I like wore every article of clothing that I owned for a solid year without doing laundry because I couldn't.
Wow.
Yeah. And eventually called like a laundry facility because I couldn't leave my
Wow.
house. Yeah.
So how long did you taper the 20 milligrams of Valium?
It was something like 2 years, 18 months along those lines. Yeah.
And did you notice anything happen when you quote unquote jumped or nothing?
Nothing was different. No. So it wasn't like some big event like it was the first time. You know, again, I think I was already having protracted withdrawal, even still on the 20 milligrams. And this, it was kind of just maybe like a buffer enough to stop the akathisia. But other than that, it didn't do much. And the taper was kind of uneventful, honestly. Yeah.
And when do you notice some sort of healing or, you know, whatever you want to call it, getting less ill or getting better? When does that happen for you?
It's such a hard question to answer because it, again, was like just over time, like very in the beginning years, it was like not noticeable, you know, like it just felt like 5, 6, 7 years of like barely making any gains. And then there was a point where it started happening. But if you'd asked me at the time, you know, are you healing? I would have said, I'm still so incredibly, like everything is still so hard. But I could acknowledge that some healing had happened at some point. So I would say like 6 or 7 years was when I really started noticing, like, okay, I can start going for walks now. I started attending like Christmas and Thanksgiving, where the first 7 years or so, I didn't even go to family functions. Like, I literally did not leave my apartment unless my parents came over to see me. I didn't do anything. So, yeah. But even
Wow.
then, like, my first Thanksgiving with the family, I spent like in the basement freaking out. My dad had to come down there and was like, do you want to go home? Like, it was a whole ordeal. So it wasn't like I was like, I'm better. You know, I was just able to try for the first time, really.
Right. That's really intense.
Yeah.
So when do you notice at least some more quality of life returning to your life, you know,
Yeah.
when you
From that point on, it was just, again, each year I think was like more and more gains, like a little bit more and a little bit more. And I started like taking things back that I had lost, you know, like, okay, when I first started walking, I was so deconditioned. You lay in bed for 7 years, you know, I was like my skin just like hung off my body. So I had no muscle. So I started walking like to the next street and back. And then I would go a little bit further and then and further. And now I can walk like a lot. I can walk miles and miles and like actually enjoy the exercise. So I have like more physical, way more physical stamina than I did. But I still have things now. Like, if you asked me to like do strenuous exercise, I think my body would completely freak out. Like, I couldn't handle it. But I can go for long walks, you know? So I still have limitations that I definitely didn't have before the drugs. And I'm like much more sensitive to panic and anxiety than ever before. You know, if you put me in certain situations where it feels like really stressful or overwhelming, like I'll still freak out, you know, stuff like that. But I can do more and try more. And I'm not sitting here every day like thinking about dying, wishing I could just like end my life or not suffer. You know, like I can do things now where I'm not totally hyper-focused on how I feel 24/7, if that makes sense.
It does make sense. And for the audience again, so when did you stop taking the your last dose of Valium, when was that?
I want to say, okay, October 2010 was the detox.
Right.
I was off for like 4 to 5 months after that, you know, the severe withdrawal. Then I reinstated and then I tapered for like 18 to 24 months after that. So
right.
Looking at like I'm almost 11 years free of benzos, I think.
Right.
Yeah, but
right.
13 since the detox.
So, Nicole, when did you decide that you wanted to become an advocate for the benzo harmed community?
Pretty early on. I mean, I think it was like most people. At first, I was angry. I mean, I was like pissed that this was happening and that the medical community was denying it and so many people were suffering so horrendously and for so long. Eventually, I think anger is a withdrawal symptom, as I mentioned. Like, I think rage, like when the guy put the cold drink, you know, that's so physiological, you can't help it. So I think some of it was just my system being so deranged, but also just like natural anger. Like, who wouldn't be pissed that this happened, you know? But over time, I got less mad and like more like accepting, like, okay, it's not serving me to be this rageful. In fact, I think it's probably making me sicker to be angry all the time.
It's so insidious, in my opinion, the benzo withdrawal, the rage is kind of like, I agree with you. Like, you know, we have every right to be angry at so many things, but in benzo withdrawal or bind, it just seems to be magnified like 1,000-fold.
1,000. Yeah. I mean, you know, they call that neuro emotions. I don't know if you've heard that term.
That's no first time.
Yeah. It happens too with like guilt and, you know, all kinds of other emotions. I think people on withdrawal report, like it feels so intense, like the anger that I feel or the rage or the guilt or, you know, the sadness. And that's kind of like when people say like, you can't really trust your emotions in withdrawal because a lot of them are intensified. They're neuro emotions. They're from your neurophysiology, essentially being out of whack from the medications. So
right.
It's hard though, because they feel real.
That's the thing. Yeah. So how do you get affiliated with the Benzodiazepine Information Coalition?
I honestly don't remember.
That's okay. Okay. But you are aligned with them and
yes.
You do work for them and with them.
Whenever they formed, I just thought, oh, this is great. You know, somebody's finally like put a nonprofit together, because in the U.S., you know, having nonprofit status kind of means something. And, you know, so I joined early on after they first formed and just started working together with them to try to, you know, we had to get the website going and like make BIC what BIC is today. So,
right. Yeah. Right. And if my memory serves me well, you're also on the board with Critch Page, and he has a foundation for akathisia. So you're on that board as well. And you've picked up coaching at DeWitt, if I'm correct, right?
Yeah, Whit Daring Psychiatry. Yeah, I do some taper withdrawal coaching over there, mostly just, you know, providing people who don't know anything about tapering. And sometimes their doctors come along too, which makes me happy when we have, you know, physicians or nurse practitioners or PAs who join the coaching sessions or just like want to learn, you know, how do people taper these drugs, or like what is withdrawal all about? How do you support somebody in a situation like this? What resources are available? Because some people don't find the groups. They don't know that our community even exists. You know, they're starting from ground zero, scratch.
Right. Yeah. So in your kind of, well, you're still in your journey. What has changed for the better, in your opinion, in this whole drug harmed community and prescribing and deprescribing?
Oh, so many things. I mean, unfortunately, I've been here since 2010, so I've got to see all of it, you know.
Right.
There's so much more media attention now than there ever was before. There's films, documentaries out about it now that we didn't have. Not just by people who've been through it, you know, like Holly Hardman's As Prescribed. She obviously made the documentary because she experienced it herself, but mainstream, you know, like BBC just put out something about antidepressant harms recently. Yep. There was Lisa Ling doing the benzo thing. Just way more stuff than was ever around when I first showed up. And then all of you who are listening out in the benzo land, I call it. You know, telling your stories on YouTube and like being so brave and putting information out there, like it's just like blown up, I think. And then we have doctors too, I think more on our side that are coming forward, like Dr. Whit Daring. We have Mark Horowitz, you know, the Peter Goetches of the world. And so there's more people out there, you know, in the medical field too, I think, advocating for us than there was long ago as well.
Right, right. So,
and the FDA, hello.
Yeah, like, the black box warning. Yeah, I'm still waiting for one for in this country.
Yeah,
we'll keep on waiting. And as a wrap up, I always ask my every single guest, people listening in withdrawal right now, what would you recommend them or want to tell them?
Oh, gosh, I would just say, you know, don't tell yourself the lies that benzo withdrawal wants your brain to tell you. You know, those, like I said, those neuro emotions and things, it's all physiologically generated and it's not true. So those scared, terrorized feelings that you have, like I'm never going to heal, I'm the worst of all, nobody has this, it can't be this bad for anybody else, it's just me, I'm never going to get better. It's not true. You will get better. I've seen so many people in, you know, all the years that I've been around who heal, and I still keep in touch with like tons of friends that I had from the early days who are long, long gone, like living their lives. They laugh about how crazy they were, and you know, it's like funny to them now.
Right.
Like, oh, remember that time I like lost my mind, you know, and now I'm better, you know.
Right, right.
You get
right.
your humor back, like you become yourself again. And for those of you and protracted like me, you know, like I said, it's not the intensity that it is in the beginning years, like forever. It does let up. You get like more footing and you just kind of claw your way out of this hell until you're not doing that every single second like you were in the beginning. And then finally, I'll just steal from Matt Samet, like what he said when I asked him the same question is like, don't kill yourself. Don't give up, you know.
Thank you so much for your time, Nicole.
Of course, thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to the episode. Be well, be safe, remember it's not a race, and don't forget to subscribe and rate the show.